Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Callan, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Welcome back to Risk Revolution, our monthly series seeking to advance the maturity of risk management practices across the life science sector. As usual, we'll be covering topics that challenge professionals within the biopharmaceutical and medtech industries, and we aim to shake up the paradigm to revolutionize the ways in which we perceive and proactively manage risk. So, well, the band is back together. Lori, Val and myself, Nuala, wish a warm welcome back to all our old listeners and hopefully introduce ourselves to some new followers. We've a lot to celebrate.
Yes. So I'm so glad to be back, Nuala. I wasn't able to join both of you for some of the last few episodes, but today is our 20th episode. And I also want to point out it is the 20th anniversary of ICHQ9 Quality Risk Management Guidance Document, which we will be covering today. So I'm glad to be back. New energy hitting 2025 with a running start.
Yeah. And of course, let's acknowledge that both yourself and Lori and Val had a busy year in 2024, completing your own PhDs, researching lots of topics and designing practical frameworks and recommendations that are very relevant to our Risk Revolution mission. So I can assure our listeners that we will be exploring some of Val and Lori's research findings and getting them to share their insights in future episodes. But yes, for this special 20th episode and our 20th anniversary of QRM, we want to wish happy birthday to QRM and ICHQ9. So Val, you got to mark this occasion in a special way. You got to interview someone pretty special, a true thought leader and a colleague of ours.
I did indeed, Nuala. I sat down with Dr. Kevin O'Donnell.
He is a professor now, correct?
Correct. He is a professor, promoted or recognized for his work, I think, because we would agree he's a founding father of QRM. And that's not even the day job. In the day job, he's the market compliance manager with the Irish regulator, the HPRA. He was the rapporteur of the expert working group that worked on the ICHQ9 update to R1, and he's the chair of the expert circle on QRM within PIC. So he certainly has been on this journey from the beginning. So it was great to sit down with him and reflect on the last 20 years and gain some insights on what we can expect going into the future. So yeah, it was a great opportunity to interview him. But before we play the interview, just to say that Professor O'Donnell shared his personal thoughts and insights, and they don't necessarily represent the views of the HPRA, the ICH, or PIC. So let's listen to the interview. Thanks, Kevin, for joining the Risk Revolution podcast for this episode, which is a special episode celebrating the birthday or the anniversary of ICHQ9. It's hard to believe it's 20 years now since it was first issued and when it introduced QRM into our pharmaceutical quality systems, into the product life cycle in general, if you like. And so I'm curious, Kevin, like from where you're sitting, like, what has been achieved in that time? And, you know, how has it improved our understanding of pharmaceutical quality and risk, etc.?
Yeah, thank you very much, Valerie, for the invitation, first of all, to be here today with you. And for that question, so I think, you know, looking back over the last 20 years, so much has been achieved, not just in the GMP area from a quality risk management viewpoint, but in all aspects really of pharmaceutical regulation, especially product dossier reviews and assessment, and of course, GMP. So I think we've made very substantial changes to that regulatory framework, because prior to Q9 coming out in 2005, I think especially from a GMP viewpoint, we had a very deterministic or fixed rule approach to GMP, where the GMPs were the way to do things. What they said was really what the expectation, I guess, was for companies to comply with. And I guess there was little leeway to do things differently, even things which may give the same or a higher level of quality assurance and the quality of medicines produced. So we had a very deterministic environment prior to November 2005. November 2005 then saw Q9 come in, and really that seems to have been the quality guideline from the Q8, Q9, Q10 package, at least the guideline which really got people's attention very quickly. And within Europe, we started to fairly quickly modernize the GMPs to reflect the Q9 guidance, to reflect risk-based principles and approaches. And that work has continued to this day, right to the 2023 revision of Annex 1 for sterile product manufacturing. You'll see that there are so many references in that annex to risk and to quality risk management. We had the 80 MPs, GMPs come out, I think in 2017, 2018. There's a whole chapter in there regarding risk-based approaches and risk-based ways of manufacturing and controlling 80 MPs. Probably wouldn't have been possible without the Q9 guideline and without the maturity we had by 2017, 2018 in QRM. But when I do mention maturity there, my intention is not to overstate the mark, because I don't think the industry nor its regulators were actually that mature in the application of QRM by 2017 to 2018. But we're going to come, you've got a question for me, I know, regarding that. So we'll come to that in a few minutes' time. But from a positivist viewpoint, I do think that the change brought about by Q9 in 2005 was fundamentally very significant. It really did result in a very substantial modernization of the GMPs and guidance which went along with it. And really, the credit should not just be with the regulators for doing that, because while the regulators did publish a lot of new guidance based on risk and risk-based approaches to GMP, to assessment, other work, the industry also really did run with it, and they developed many, many working groups from early on to develop really good guidances for manufacturing medicines using risk-based principles. So there were so many that one can draw on. A few would come to mind. RiskMap was one from ISPE, which was about risk-based cleaning validation and cross-contamination concerns. We had a lot of work from PDA. Most recently, actually, the PDA have updated the drug shortages and technical report, I think it's tier 54, to make substantial changes to it in light of the Q9 revision. But that document originally came out around, I think, 2013, 2014, which was really there to reflect the issue of drug shortages, which was becoming a globalized issue by then. And that report really did provide a lot of good risk-based approaches to try and deal with drug shortages. Now, we're not there yet, and the problem of drug shortages has continued, and some may say it's gotten worse, so we've a lot more work to do. But generally speaking, I think we've gone in the right direction to ensure we are trying to manufacture medicines based on risk consideration, and we're trying to regulate companies and regulate products based on risk considerations too, because none of us has all the resources we would like to have. We probably will never have. We live in an increasingly complex world, one which is, you know, plagued with a lot of problems, geopolitical and others, and also problems regarding supply chains, medicines availability being the ultimate expression of those difficulty. So we've a lot more to do. We've a lot of complexity to try to address. And actually, complexity was one of the key drivers behind some of the new guidance we put in to the revised version of Q9, which came out in 2023, which was ICH Q9 R1. And I just want to say that I was very privileged to act as the rapporteur for that work. But the real the credit must go to the expert working group who developed that revised version of the guideline between 2020 and 2024, and who continues to work via a slimmed down version called the Q9 R1 training group now. The credit, I think, must go to ICH and to the ICH observers and members who really did support the idea to revise Q9 to address certain issues. And I just wanted to mention that.
That's very important, yeah. I like the way that you remind us, though, of what positive influence it has had. You know, I suppose when I look back to when I started in the industry, we were all making tablets. There was a very narrow range of dosage forms and product types. And, you know, now, I mean, the range of therapies and manufacturing technologies, there has been such a flourish of that in the last 20 years. And I suppose QRM has enabled that by, you know, as you said, making things less deterministic and rule bound. And that is such a, you know, a positive influence. But it did, as you pointed out, need a little bit of course directing. Coming from all sides, we probably were all a little bit innocent when we wrote the original version, perhaps. And, you know, it became obvious that maybe some improvements were necessary, and you've alluded to that. So moving on to, you know, the release of the updated version, which we refer to as ICHQ9R1, in November 2023, and that introduced some clarifications, which hopefully will enhance the effectiveness of QRM. So what are your hopes for that revision, and what do you hope the industry will how they will perceive it and what they will do with it, and, you know, what do you like to see happening next?
Yeah, thank you, Valerie. So, you know, looking back over the last 3, 4, 5 years, I think the use of quality risk management and the risk-based approaches to medicines manufacturing and medicines regulation has served us really well, actually. And, you know, one example of that, I think, was COVID pandemic. You know, we learned very quickly during Q1, Q2, 2020 globally that supply chains were fractured and would become even more fractured through the pandemic. And I think the risk-based approach and Q9 especially did help a lot to support the regulatory flexibilities, which the regulators did roll out very, very quickly. So you may remember that in April 2020, the EMA published the initial number of flexibilities relating to medicines assessment and manufacturing, which started to be focused on supply chain issues and granting flexibilities to enable supply chains to have workarounds to ensure that the materials needed to manufacture and make available medicines to the globalized marketplaces were available, and to facilitate supply chain flexibility, risk-based guidance was published in April 2020, which then was revised in later in April, or maybe mid-April, and then in late May, early June, we had new guidance there. So there were 3 publications in Europe regarding those flexibility is called the Q&A for, I think, maybe the COVID pandemic, which were really fundamentally important and fundamentally based on risk. So it is important that before we do speak about the problems we have encountered with QRM, we are still benefiting from the Q9 guidance, which was published in 2005 and which did make very large differences to GMP and assessment. But we did, though, start to realise early on, I think, that all was not completely well with the implementation of QRM, I think, mainly by the industry, but evidence then started to come to us as regulators that, you know, we also had a lot to learn in identifying hazards and in managing risk. And I know myself, when I started inspecting very quickly after 2005, we were starting to see more and more risk assessments from GMP manufacturers, and we were seeing more and more deficiencies in the risk assessments we were seeing and in the general approach to QRM. QRM, I guess, was not evolving the way that it probably should have. The emphasis was very much on risk assessment, not on the wider, more holistic management of risk, which QRM is supposed to be. But anyway, so for many years, we were quite poor approaches to risk assessment, highly subjective risk assessment outputs. The risk assessments we were seeing at sites didn't withstand much regulatory scrutiny. The ratings were fundamentally very easy to challenge and really were not very science-based, very subjective and lacking objectivity. not just ratings, but I think all aspects of risk assessment probably had issues, poor approaches to hazard identification, maybe an overuse of one tool, FMEA, to the detriment of the benefits to be gained from other tools. So that very much happened early on, I think. And my own thinking was that the industry probably stagnated then after it started to use FMEAs quite a lot. It seemed to have stagnated over then many years without very much learning being made regarding how to do good risk assessments. And, you know, one expression of that was the nitrosamines crisis, which started in about, I think, June, July 2018, I think. So we began to see that all was not well within the management of process changes, some API companies, and then that whole nitrosamines issue opened up a very wide-ranging issue we were seeing in the lack of process understanding, the lack of product understanding, the lack of good risk-based approaches to managing changes, to managing manufacturing process, to understanding risks and the hazards which were giving rise to those risks. And we're still really, you know, working through those issues. The nitrosamines crisis hasn't gone away. We've had recent recalls in Ireland due to high levels of nitrosamines in medicinal products, you know, and many countries have too. The industry is still working through nitrosamine risk assessments. And in Europe, we had this thing called the Article 5 Refer, I think, which came out around 2019, I think, and it required all the companies who are marketing chemical-based medicines to risk assess their products and processes, including the API process for nitrosamine risks. And we were seeing very, in some cases, quite poor risk assessments. So there were quite a lot of flags. QRM wasn't operating as it should. And so that really ultimately led to the revision of the guideline, which started its work in 2020. And so the revision really was focused initially on four main areas. Number one was subjectivity in QRM. That issue I just spoke about, very subjective risk ratings, very subjective outputs of QRM generally, was being seen increasingly by inspectors as a problem. Product availability risks, in other words, drug shortage risks, was by then on everybody's mind as a really large-scale problem, which was highly complex, requiring quite complicated and complex solutions to it. Those solutions haven't yet reached fruition, I think, so we still have very significant problems with drug shortages. The third revision topic for the revision was formality in QRM, and the fourth one was risk-based decision-making. And while I was thinking this evening about, you know, this podcast, I was thinking that those areas, formality and QRM, subjectivity and risk-based decision-making, they are difficult areas to get right. But I think that the evolution of QRM, especially in GMP for the last 20 years, went ahead very quickly, like I was saying earlier on. But I don't think we as practitioners did enough work early on to understand the basics of those things. You know, understanding where subjectivity comes from, how it gets expressed in probability estimates through the influences of human heuristics and other types of bias. We didn't stop to learn much about those things. And there were people in the world who had published a lot of important learnings and knowledge just about those very things. And I don't think we as an industry reviewed that literature and learned from it. Likewise, risk-based decision making. There is a lot known about how human beings make decisions and how we make risk-based decisions. Much of that knowledge was not embedded in the pharmaceutical industry or in the pharmaceutical-related publications. It was in journals which we don't tend to read. You know, so, and likewise, what the issue of formality and trying to get the right level of formality to be commensurate with the level of risk when we're doing QRM activities, that is a difficult thing to get right. The guideline in 2005 really correctly did recognize that formality was an issue that needs to be thought about. It was so important that it made its way into, I think, one of the two principles of QRM, which are in the guideline, but it kind of stopped there. The learning about what is formality in QRM, how to define different levels of formality, that kind of learning didn't happen, I think. And I think we ended up with a very binary, simplistic situation of saying things are either informal or formal without much understanding of what those two things meant or how they're different from each other. So I think those issues generally led to us not getting the benefits from QRM, which we should have been realizing for many years since 2005. And so those things, I guess, were the triggers behind the revision work in 2020, which then ultimately led to the revised guideline, which you said earlier, Valerie, SESQ9R1, came out in January 2023.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting there when you said, I mean, there's so much out there to be known about risk science. I didn't even realize risk science was a topic until I joined you guys as a researcher. Our listeners will know the connection between yourself and the host of the podcast is we belong to the same research team. And, you know, to go out there and explore what other industries know about risk science and that risk science is a kind of a scientific topic on its own. And it just opens our eyes. And I suppose, is there a fear, Kevin? You know, I think something you have kind of said in there is that maybe we took ICHQ9, the first version, a little too literally. And is there a hazard we might take the update a little too literally as well? And maybe what we want to do is open people's minds up that there is a lot to think about here.
Yeah, very much. I'm really glad you asked me that question, Valerie. As you know, I think one of the mistakes we probably all made starting in 2005 was that I think in the pharmaceutical industry anyway, we treated ICHQ9 as the gold standard, was everything we needed to be able to drive risk-based approaches in GMP and in pharmaceutical regulation generally. Q9 was never intended to be even a standard, let alone a gold standard. It is a pretty high-level guidance document, really, which sets out high-level principles, high-level guidance regarding tools for QRM and potential applications of QRM, and it speaks about at a high level what QRM is, what the different elements of it are, how they might work. But generally, it was quite high level, non-prescriptive guidance, very different from some of the ISO standards we see, which deal with risk management and say other industries or even generally. So maybe we treated Q9 as the gold standard when it was never written to be like that or intended to be like that. And maybe that led us to not looking beyond it, not learning from the literature in other areas. So experimental psychologists, they've published widely since the late 1960s, early 1970s, regarding how people make probability estimates, you know, the actual mechanics of giving probability judgments are very much interlinked with psychological processes regarding how our brains work, how human heuristics and other sources of bias interfere. They, in some cases, they do help, but they often interfere with our judgments regarding things of probability and severities, other things. So there was a lot of research that we could have been benefiting from, which I don't think we did benefit from. Moving to, say, risk-based decision-making, you know, many industries had quite good guidance developed in that very topic, risk-based decision-making, for, you know, decades. And the uptake of that guidance and knowledge probably in our industry was low. I know, Valerie, you just have finished your own PhD in that very area. So now is the perfect time for our listeners to get the most up-to-date learning and thinking and knowledge on the topic of risk-based decision-making in the pharmaceutical GMP environment from your own research, Valerie. So those things, I think, probably happened. We probably weren't aware of those things having happened. The lack of us looking outwards and not just inwards at ourselves and our industry probably has not served as well. So I'm hoping that you ask me, you know, might the same happen with the revised version? Well, that could very much happen. So I would like to make the point here that, we must not treat Q9 or 1 as any gold standard. It is still a high-level, non-prescriptive guidance. Yes, it has been improved, I think, quite a lot through the recent version, but there is so much in it that points to other places of learning. We would hope within the expert working group that people will take the guidance and will then start to think about, okay, how do I learn more about subjectivity in QRM? How do I learn more about what is good risk-based decision making? How do we address the problems of misperception of hazards and risk? How do we identify hazards? We've got two very good training presentations published now since October 2023 on the ICS website, which deal with hazard identification. And so I'm hoping that these things, the new guideline revision and the training materials, yes, will serve as good learning for us all, but also, more importantly, will trigger stakeholders to look beyond those things and to seek out their own learning and knowledge and to publish, more on these topics, to develop good training materials which go beyond maybe the training materials we developed in the S working group. Because we were limited in our time to do that and resources. So there's a lot more knowledge to be gained, and hopefully the Q9 revision will just be a trigger for that.
And I would like to congratulate the team that you mentioned on the training material that was published, because it is very enlightening. And not picking any topic out in particular, but I did find the training material in support of the hazard identification to be very thought-provoking and illuminating, really, to be honest. So, these are well worth a read. And hopefully the whole exercise will encourage people to seek to be more knowledgeable about this space and not take it so literally, but to be encouraged and incentivized to become more knowledgeable in this area. But, and my final question for you, Kevin, is even as we learn, and we're all on a learning journey here, in many ways we measure ourselves by some yardstick. And I suppose, rightly or wrongly, the yardstick we most commonly used in our industry is how we're getting on in regulatory inspections and GMP and site inspections. So, with that in mind, with the new revision, what can we expect from the inspection processes going forward that perhaps we haven't met already following this update?
Yeah, thanks, Valerie. So I guess my own personal hope is that the way we inspect GMP and especially how we inspect how companies manage risk, I do hope that that will become more informed using the guidance and Q9 or 1 and using the Q9 or 1 training materials. So I would hope that over the next few years, companies will start to see the evidence of that, that inspectors will start to ask questions of companies which they weren't asking before. And actually, we did within the European regulatory framework, we began thinking about changing the European GMPs. We had a workshop on it within the inspectors working group at EMA, I think in November 2023, to start the discussion regarding how should the European GMPs change in light of the Q9 revision. And we've been doing a lot of work in that space. And interestingly, we consulted with the industry about that very early on to get their thoughts regarding should the GMPs be updated to reflect some of the concepts in Q9 or 1? And if so, what did they think about our initial thinking for updates? And we got a lot of responses back from industry. Now, I do have to say that the responses were mixed. There were some respondents who were very positively disposed to the idea to update the GMPs, like I say, others were not, but we've gone ahead. We've been working very hard at the European level to work through what changes we might need, and we're nearly there now at this stage, so we're at an advanced level. So the GMPs will likely change to some degree. We're not making many large-scale changes to the GMPs if the changes get through the final review process. We'll be making very targeted revisions to mainly Chapter 1 of the European GMP Guide, which is about the pharmaceutical quality system. And we are trying to ensure that the real core key messages from the Q9 or 1 guidance will be reflected in there. So I'm hoping that we will start to see that soon. that inspectors then will use that guidance to ask more tailored and specific questions when looking at how companies are managing risk. So deviation processes, change management, validation, complaints, quality defects, training, whatever. And I'm hoping that the industry will use this as an opportunity to, you know, to work with regulators to try to ensure that this new guidance is implemented correctly and, you know, not misunderstood. So using the training materials, which were published in October 2023, would be a good thing. And I have to say that under 2 weeks' time, we have about 200 plus inspectors coming to EMA to learn about the new guidance and Q9 R1 through using those training materials. So we have got a three-day training event about to start for not just European GMP inspectors, but inspectors from all around the world who are coming to EMA to learn more about the Q9 R1 revision through the training materials. So much of the training material which will be presented during those 3 days will be the actual training slide decks and case studies which have been published. We're adding a bit to those materials to make them a bit more interactive for workshops. But my message is that we as regulators are working to upskill ourselves to learn about what this new guidance really means from a GMP inspection viewpoint. And I would hope that the industry will use the same training materials and educate itself regarding these revisions to the guideline. That way, I'm hoping that we will achieve some level of harmonization in our thinking regarding things like subjectivity in QRM, formality, risk-based decision-making, product availability risks, hazard ID, and risk review.
Well, now, Kevin, you've put the whole industry on alert there to read those training materials, which, you know, not to reiterate again, but they are a rich, rich resource for both the regulators and the industry. So let's encourage our listeners, and we'll put in links to those materials in the podcast notes, I think, given we now our eyes are opened as to how important they may be in the future. We could talk about the various topics you've mentioned forever here, but there is a limit on the time in a podcast. But maybe you'll come back in some future episode and explore some of these topics in more detail. You've been a great guest, and thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you very much, Valerie, for having me. A real pleasure always working with you, Valerie, and thank you all.
Well, first of all, well done, Val, on capturing Kevin long enough to conduct a really insightful interview. He's a national treasure here in Ireland and well known globally. I think for me, the big takeaway must be that we need to all work together to ensure that the opportunity offered by this update to Q9R1 is not squandered once again by either the industry or the regulators, particularly the inspectors, by taking it too literally. I loved your question, Val, about, you know, the fact that how can we avoid that problem that happened with ICH Q9, the original version? And as Kevin said, you know, that it was taken too deterministically. I really like the fact that he emphasized Q9 or one, or even the original Q9, was never intended as a gold standard or even a standard. And he was really clear on how historically there's been a lack of looking outwards by the pharmaceutical industry. And particularly, I loved how he expressed his hope for how this will go in the future, that the new materials should, in fact, act as a trigger for stakeholders to seek out more learning and materials. And of course, they set the guideline, but it is just a guideline. So it's critical. For me, it's critical that this updated guideline and the associated training materials that you both spoke about serve as a springboard or a jumping off point to really encourage curiosity within practitioners within the industry about how other industries and other disciplines utilize risk science and even decision science, which I'm sure we'll come back to, Val, on the basis of your own research. to develop best practices in areas of perhaps proactively reducing the impact of subjectivity, or how we make judgments and decisions, or how to use data and science to determine these probability estimates, and even defining a varying array of formality practices along a kind of fit for purpose spectrum. But ultimately, fundamentally, in assuring that how we identify these hazards that can lead to risks is led by science and not by gut. So hopefully, in a small way, our little Risk Revolution podcast can act as a conduit for some of this knowledge flow across the sector and learning. But just before I hand over, just another thought on the impact of QRM on the updating of GMPs. One other area that was mentioned by Kevin, which no doubt many of our listeners are feeling the impact of on their everyday operations, is the fundamental shift towards risk-based approaches in sterile manufacture through the update to Annex 1. So we should return to this topic, I think, in future episodes, and in particular, the transformation of the role of an effective risk-based contamination control strategy and the role it plays in monitoring and driving continuous improvement in proactive daily practices and behaviours from possibly what was formerly a document that got signed off and sat on a shelf to some extent. What do you think, Val?
Yeah, and also the role in supporting decision making as well, right? Which I think is very important. Anyway, Laurie, what did you think of the interview? What struck you from it?
Oh, I loved it. First of all, as always, lots of nuggets of and gems of information from both of you from the risk perspective. I've been doing risk management for a long time. I'm still always learning, especially from Kevin as a regulator and now as a professor. But I wanted to just add that I totally agree with you, Nuala, on the part of how we really took it very prescriptive, I think, in the industry when ICH Q9 came out. We took it from a very, I think, compliance perspective, as we kind of do think in our industry, I think. I know at the time I was actually in a global role, and when we rolled it out at our very large global company, it was very fixated on tools, processes, procedures, as we do in quality. I think what we forgot are the people and the behaviors that needed to go with. And I think because we became so prescriptive, it became somewhat overwhelming. And then we were challenged in the industry to really adopt QRM for what it really brought to the business, which was to help with decision making. We sort of got wrapped up in the documentation and how do I do an FMEA? Where do I write this down in my quality system? How do I archive the information? And we sort of got away from the benefits of what it really brings to our decision making and the gift that the regulators provided us with being able to make risk-based decisions. So I'm totally on board with that decision. I did want to add, and I actually want to enhance that risk science piece. I'd love for us to go back and sort of talk more about that in another session, maybe. I also wanted to just add to the list of things that Kevin mentioned that ICH Q9 has really influenced. And I know that ICH Q9 is very focused on QRM from the perspective of GMPs and manufacturing, but I believe strongly that it's also influenced the GCP world, the good clinical practices world. ICH E6 R3 is coming out this year, but R2 has been in circulation for quite some time. Heavy discussions around QRM, quality management, the role that that plays in protecting the patient and the data integrity for that study. And I think that's something we don't get into a lot because that's not ICH Q9's focus, I know, but I just want to sort of bookend that product life cycle and show that it's really throughout, which I know it's in the development piece, but we don't really talk about it from that clinical piece. And they're very heavily influenced and very much in alignment actually with the language in ICH Q9 as well. And then computer system validation. They've been practicing this for a long time and really pushing this from the data integrity perspective and the computer systems piece. So I think that one is kind of in there, but we don't really talk about it. And it's been there and it's been around for a long time and they're really good practitioners from a risk perspective. So I wanted to kind of send a shout out to that. And then the last piece is the training material that ICH offers. Fabulous. I saw the first version and I've now seen this latest version. Such an upgrade. So many case studies in there. I highly recommend that people look at that for their companies. And I also recommend that we're careful about the maturity of where a company's at when you're looking at this training material. If you were to deploy this and you weren't sort of in that behavior place where you're ready to make risk decisions, and your leadership teams are ready to think about risk-informed decisions, some of this might be too complex and too mature yet. You might have to dial some of it back and slow that roll down when you deploy QRM to really start thinking about, what does it even mean to think about risk? How do I even think about risk in a decision? Am I ready to even talk about risk? Because sometimes that's psychologically very difficult for people to think about the downside of something. We always want to think about the benefit. And it's hard for us to sometimes manage risk from that perspective. So I love that content and material. I think it's fabulous. Just be prepared to sort of understand what your business need is for your company and what you would deploy and roll out to really make it be a sizable chunk of information for people to receive. But that's my thoughts. Loved the interview. Thank you, Val. Your thoughts.
I agree strongly about the training materials. They're a really informative additional resource there. And I encourage everyone interested in QRM to read them. For me, you know, and I would regard myself as shoulder deep in QRM at this stage, the training materials on hazard identification were hugely clarifying. And again, you know, maybe we'll come back to that in a future episode as well. But Laurie, I love the point you're making there. You know, QRM, risk science, it's a mindset, it's a way of thinking, a way of managing our operations, whatever that is, you know, whether it's clinical or computer validation or manufacturing processes. I think the tools are just that, they're the tools, and we've got very performative about them. Whereas that maybe we need to put them back in their toolbox and start thinking about how we think about risk in our operations. And yeah, I think Kevin's reminder that this is just a minimum sort of requirement. It's not the gold star by any means. You know, it really is a North Star thought, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you, Laurie. We'll come back to it. We've covered it in previous episodes, this whole concept of culture and maturity of the company in terms of their ability to take on some of these practices. But, you know, again, we'll come back to this. But I guess, ladies, that's a wrap for our first Risk Revolution episode of the year. And just to let everyone know that we'll be back each month with a whole range of topics and a mix of guest interviews and quarterly roundups on what's new or what's bad or what's good of what we're hearing. And we're even being ambitious enough to set ourselves the task of putting up a book club. So you'll be hearing more about that in the future. But we hope to be able to share some of our favorite authors and books in the areas of critical thinking, risk science, decision science, leadership and human behavior as well, in the search of us being this conduit for knowledge flow and learning about how we can strengthen our risk-based approaches. And ultimately, as Kevin says, to better assure product availability to the patients that we serve. So please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, so new episodes will miraculously make their way into your feed. We have also set up a new LinkedIn Risk Revolution podcast page. So please do join us there and feel free to message us with your thoughts and ideas. And finally, Val, what are you going to share in the show notes this month?
Yeah, in the show notes, not forgetting we're on YouTube as well. The show notes. So this month, I think we'll include the links to ICHQ 901 and the training material. I'm hoping nobody needs those links, but we put them there anyway. Kevin mentioned the nitrosamine issue, and there's a really interesting document published by the EMA on their lessons learned from that whole drama. So I think that is an interesting read for anybody in our business. And I think we'll also, because Kevin mentioned as well, we'll put up the link to the guidance he mentioned on using risk to address drug shortages that was published by the PDA. Now, that will be behind a paywall, so it will be just for members of the PDA, but I'm sure a lot of our listeners are also members of the PDA, so we'll add that link as well. So happy reading, everybody. And from me, Val, till the next time.
And it's goodbye from Nuala.
Goodbye from Laurie.
Cheers.